Some things shouldn't be transparent, like stop signs. But what you pay for should always be clear, like Hiller's True Transparency Pricing, always clearly itemized and never any hidden fees. Because you have the right to know what you're paying for. For more information, visit happyhiller.com/true-transparency-pricing. Happy you'll be, or the service is free.
Call the Happy Face Truck today.
Midday 180, served up by Wendy's. John Feinstein will join us in a matter of minutes. Getting him on the phone currently. He's been covering the U.S. Open, Shinnecock Hills. Very opinionated on what happened. I'm eager to talk with him about Phil Mickelson, but we'll also discuss a lot with Brooks Koepka. And then the other big storylines from the U.S. Open, where Paul and I agree. Watching some of the best in the world, or the best in the world, struggle in one of the majors out of the year is not that big of a deal for us.
No.
It's just as entertaining to me. In some cases, more entertaining.
I don't like the whining from the players or some of the fans who seem to, or reporters who seem to really object to the difficult level. I don't like the apologizing. I think courses often get harder from the beginning of the day to the end of the day, or vice versa, based on conditions, and that's part of it. Though I guess them admitting that it didn't play out fairly that way is all right.
John Feinstein, author, contributor to the Golf Channel, columnist for the Washington Post. He joins us on the Midday 180, served up by Wendy's. John, will the 118th U.S. Open, will it be remembered by you as being entertaining or unfair?
Good question, Jonathan. I would say both. It was certainly entertaining in different ways. Thursday, watching the guys struggle and those five wins on what was probably a fair golf course setup was entertaining. Yesterday was entertaining when the USGA set the golf course up to allow for low scores. But I would also say that Phil Mickelson's behavior on Saturday is unfortunately going to be a part of the story, and the USGA letting the golf course get away Saturday afternoon is also going to be part of the story. Golf tournaments can be very complicated to break down, and this one would certainly fit that description.
We'll certainly get your thoughts on Phil Mickelson coming up. There's no better illustration in the change in the course from Saturday to Sunday than Tommy Fleetwood. He made 8 birdies and a bogey a day after the entire course saw just 3 players break par. What changed right from Saturday night to Sunday, and how did they address the course in particular?
Well, there were 2 things, Jonathan. One was that they put a lot of water on the greens on Saturday night. That was one of two big mistakes they made in 2004 under similar weather conditions. They didn't put water on the golf course Saturday night, and they double-rolled the greens on Sunday morning so that the greens were essentially close to unplayable. This time, after what happened Saturday afternoon, knowing they had a similar weather forecast for Sunday, they put a lot of water on the greens, and they changed their plan on hole locations. Instead of going to some difficult spots that you would normally see on a championship Sunday, they more or less set it up like a senior tour course. They put most of the hole locations in the easiest spots they could find because they didn't want the players to get beaten up by the golf course on Sunday the way they were on Saturday afternoon. And they didn't want the morning players to have the advantage on Sunday that they had on Saturday, although it's not coincidence that Fleetwood was off the golf course by 4 o'clock on Sunday shooting that low score.
Don't morning players often have an advantage due to conditions elsewhere? And doesn't it get tedious to you, the constant debate about the course, USGA apologizing for it or defending it? It seems to me the course becomes too much of the story during these tournaments.
Well, you know, Paul, first of all, you're right. Frequently, morning players have the advantage on afternoon players. That's why you flip the field on Thursday and Friday. The morning guys go in the afternoon guys go in the morning. Then on Saturday and Sunday, of course, the leaders go out late. And there is sometimes an unfairness to that, but it's not usually as pronounced as it was on Saturday. I spent my boyhood growing up on the eastern shore of Long Island, and what happens is that the winds come up in the afternoon. If you spend 15 minutes there, you know that on a summer afternoon, the breeze is almost certainly going to come up off of Long Island Sound there in Southampton. So the USGA made a really bad tactical error there, setting the golf course up the way they did on Saturday. They tried to correct it on Sunday. And you're right, Paul, that too often we get caught up in golf course setups, but that's always part of the story at the U.S. Open, because the USGA, whether they admit it or not, and they don't, their ideal winning score at the U.S. Open is even par. And last year, the winning score was 16 under. They don't like that one bit. So even though Mike Davis would never say so, they wanted to set the golf course up so that the winning score would be around even par, and they got that. Brooks Koepka shot one over par to win the golf tournament, but there were some issues along the way, to put it mildly.
What did Brooks Koepka tell you about his play that he can win an Open championship like this for the U.S. Open at 16 under or at one over with the way both courses played over the last 2 years?
You know, I spent some time with Brooks Koepka when I was researching my Ryder Cup book, the first major, because he was, as you know, on the Ryder Cup team in 2016. And the thing I came away, and this was before he won an Open, but what I came away with in thinking about Brooks Koepka and learning about him by spending time with him, Jonathan, is that he's the guy who's not going to whine about the course setup, no matter what it is. He's going to look at the golf course, say, this is what I got, and this is what I have to do to succeed. He doesn't get upset about things. Dustin Johnson is the same way, but I would say that Brooks is more cerebral than Dustin Johnson. He does think about things. He understands things. This is a guy, remember, who made a conscious decision to go and play in Europe when he didn't make it to the tour right away, coming out of college, because he thought that was the way to get experience on difficult golf courses, and he did. And it's not a coincidence that he can win on a tough golf course like Shinnecock. But because he's also got such great physical skills and he can drive the ball so far, he can also win on a golf course where 16 under is winning. But I would say, you know, you look at him and you look at the forearms and you know how much he works out, and you say, oh, aha, you know, he does this because he's so strong and hits it so far. I would make the argument he does it at least as much because of his mental strength.
Koepka's par at 14 or his approach at 16, which would you lead with in a story to point where he actually won this tournament?
I'd lead with the bogey at 11. And I think he said that because he was dead. He was dead off the tee. He hit a hacker's tee shot. He had to try to play the ball into the bunker on his second shot because otherwise the ball was just going to keep coming back at him. He had a good bunker shot and then made a great putt. And remember, Dustin Johnson on that tee hit it about 20 feet, and they both ended up walking off the hole with four. I thought there could potentially be a two or even three shot change there just between Brooks and Dustin, not to mention other people. Instead, they both walked off with the same score, and you could almost see the adrenaline surge making that bogey gave to Brooks Koepka. Now, the par saves at 12 and 14 were huge. The third shot at 16 was huge, but I think he would tell you that the moment that won him the U.S. Open was making that bogey at 11.
It was a moment that lost it for Johnson.
I don't know that there was a single moment, Paul. I think he lost it on Saturday. I walked with him on Friday, and he was so dialed in. He had such control of his golf ball on a difficult course. Tiger Woods and who he was playing with, and Justin Thomas, who he was playing with, were on by what they were seeing. And they're two pretty good players themselves. I mean, Tiger Woods knows what it looks like to dominate a golf course. And that's what Dustin Johnson was doing. And he came out of the shoot on Saturday. I don't know what changed. Certainly the golf course was difficult. But usually a difficult golf course is to his advantage. Because if he can keep the ball in the fairway, he has so much control over his golf ball that a windy day gives him an advantage. Instead, he comes out, he bogeys three out of the first four holes, he shoots 41 on the front nine, and you could see his body language change. And honestly, Paul, I don't think he ever got it back.
Patrick Reed, he made it interesting, too. He started on the front blazing with birdies on five of his first eight holes yesterday, but things slowed down at the turn. But I thought his play was a reminder, John, that he's not going anywhere after his Augusta win.
I agree with you, Jonathan. Think about this. Patrick Reed had never finished in the top 10 in a major before the PGA last year. People said, well, he's got great ability. He brings all that emotion to the Ryder Cup so well, but when can he get it going in a major? Well, in his last three majors, he's finished T2, win, and fourth. That's pretty darn good. And I think he's still a young guy. He's only 27 years old. And just as Koepka's only 28. I think he's going to be a factor in majors for a long time. I remember after that classic singles match at Hazeltine in the Ryder Cup, Rory McIlroy said to me, if he can bring that kind of emotion to majors, he'll win a half dozen of them. Half dozen is a lot of majors, but I think the point Rory was making is correct. He's got the ability to win multiple majors. And he's another one who has a great attitude. He's super competitive. He loves the heat. I think he just kind of ran out of gas a little bit after the fast start yesterday. But he, like you said, he did not play well on Thursday, but he certainly got his act together the last 3 days.
John Feinstein is with us, and he does not lack an opinion on most anything, especially this past week when it comes to Phil Mickelson and the USGA. I want to know what John thought as Mickelson started to putt on the 13th green Saturday, and then as he watched him run towards the ball and swat at the opposite direction before the ball came to rest, just the initial reaction from John and the decision to not DQ him. We'll discuss that with John when we come back. We are live today, Greystone Golf Club in Dixon for the Hoosier Caddy Golf Classic. The 1 p.m. flight is off and running. I've seen a lot of scores come in, Paul. What, 59? There's a 58 that we heard.
I'm never on one of those teams.
Me either, because we're playing with Kirby. That's why. Midday 180, served up by Wendy's.
The Jeep Celebration event is going on now at Gupton. There's a great selection of the all-new 2018 Jeep JL Wrangler Unlimited and the all-new 2019 Ram 1500s reduced to employee pricing. Low, low lease payments. Listen to these three offers. The 2018 Ram 1500 Quad Express, $209 a month for 36 months with less than $3,000 due at signing. Or the Jeep Wrangler Unlimited Sport for $229 a month for 36 months with only $3,000 due at signing. Or the Jeep Renegade for $189 a month for 36 months with less than $3,000 due at signing. Whether it's for you or your business, bike, boat, camper, Gupton Motors is the right place. You've just got to go to Gupton. Give them a call at 615-384-AUTO, 615-384-2886, or simply visit them on the web at guptonmotors.com. Gupton has the great people and the great deals for any of your automotive needs. Gupton, Chrysler, Dodge, Jeep, and Ram in Springfield, just 30 minutes from downtown.
104.5 The Zone, the official station of the Tennessee Titans.
Touchdown, Titans!
And for the University of Tennessee Volunteers.
Stretches to the checkerboard. Touchdown, Tennessee!
Plus SEC matchups, Sunday night, Monday night, and Thursday night football, the NFL playoffs, and the Super Bowl. If you live for football, we've got you covered.
Oh, my goodness!
Nashville's number one sports station, 104.5 The Zone.
Midday 180 served up by Wendy's. John Feinstein is with us. The other big storyline at Shinnecock Hills over the weekend was Phil Mickelson, John. As you watched him putt on the 13th green Saturday and then watched him as he addressed the ball and ran after the ball and then swatted the moving ball back towards the hole, what were you thinking?
I was thinking, am I dreaming or is this really happening? The short form for the term that ran through my mind is WTF. I've never seen anything like that before, and I don't. You know, certainly not in a professional golf tournament. Certainly not the U.S. Open, and I don't think anybody else had either, including all the other players. You know, you might see a guy on Saturday afternoon somewhere who's participating in a tournament where you're drinking on every hole do it, but you don't see a real golfer do it in a championship event, especially one like the U.S. Open. I was completely stunned, and then Phil's explanation afterwards made it worse, because if he'd come out and said, Jonathan, geez, I just lost my mind. I was so frustrated because I was playing so poorly and the conditions were tough. And today's my 48th birthday, and I realized my chance to win a U.S. Open is flickering with each passing year. I think most people would have been sympathetic. Yeah, you shouldn't have done it, but gosh, it's understandable. But instead, after spending 20 minutes in the scoring area crafting what he was going to say to the media, because that's clearly what he was doing, he comes out and says, yeah, I did it to take advantage of the rules because I knew it would be a two-stroke penalty, but if I let the ball roll all the way down, it would have been behind the bunker again and I would have been in an impossible spot. Well, actually, if he'd let the ball roll, he could have then declared it unplayable. You can declare an unplayable lie anytime, anywhere on the golf course. And he could have gone back to the spot from which he had just cut it, or he could have moved two club lengths no closer to the hole. So if he was as smart and clever with the rules as he thought he was, that's what he would have done. But once he came out and said, I did it on purpose to take advantage of the rules, what he basically was saying in common English is, I cheated. And rule 1-2 is the second rule of golf. 1-1 describes how you play the game from tee to green. 1-2 basically is the rule that says you can't cheat. And it's ironic because in my book I have coming out in August, which is fiction, called The Prodigy, there's a scene in which 1-2 actually comes into play because somebody tries to cheat in the U.S. amateur. And the book's basically set at Augusta. But the point is, once he said that, the USGA had an obligation to the game to disqualify him because he had made a mockery of the U.S. Open. And whether the setup was terrible or not, doesn't matter. There were 67 other players who had to play the same golf course that day, and none of them did anything like that. And by the way, I like Phil Mickelson. I respect him. He's been involved in several of my books, and what I mean by that is he's been very generous with his time. He's a great interview. I think he's been good for golf through the years, but this was unacceptable. He should have been disqualified.
So if the USGA is not pointing at 1-2 for the reason why he was not disqualified, what rule are they pointing to say he was within the right to do what he did?
Well, it wasn't. They weren't saying he was within the right to do what he did. They said he broke rule 14-5. Now, 14-5 says you may not strike a moving ball. That rule is there basically for if your ball moves in the rough, or if it moves in a bunker, or if you try to tamp down your lie and the ball moves. That's basically what that rule is for. 1-2 says you may not stop a ball while it is in motion, which is among other things, which is exactly what Phil did. He stopped the ball and changed its direction. So they should have used 1-2. And what they relied on was there is a clause in 1-2. I don't mean to sound too jargony here, forgive me. But there's a clause in 1-2 which says that if another rule either prohibits the act that was committed or permits the act that was committed, then that rule shall take precedent. Well, there's nothing in 14-5 that prohibits or permits stopping a ball and changing its direction. The USGA went with 14-5 because they didn't want to disqualify him. And in fact, if he had not said what he said, I wouldn't have had a problem with them just giving him a two-shot penalty, whether through 1-2 or 14-5. But once he said what he said, they had to bring in one last rule, 33-7, which gives the committee the right to decide to disqualify someone based on facts that come to light later, or not disqualify someone. Tiger Woods signed for a wrong score in 2013 after the second round of the Masters because he had taken an illegal drop but wasn't aware that he had taken an illegal drop. When it came to light that he had taken an illegal drop, technically under the rules, he should have been disqualified. But the Masters Rules Committee decided, since they had failed to alert him that he had taken an illegal drop, even though they'd been told to look at the video, and they did, and they still screwed it up, they said, well, it was our fault that he signed for the wrong score, so under 33-7, we're not disqualifying him. In this case, the USGA under 33-7 should have said he's disqualified because he said, you know, bragged basically that he had cheated.
I can't remember if I read this at CBS or ESPN, John, so forgive me here, but I read a column yesterday that was equating what Mickelson did to a defensive back grabbing hold of a wide receiver to prevent a touchdown catch and just taking the penalty. You would what?
Yeah, well, I mean, a lot of people have brought that up, and intentionally fouling at the end of a basketball game, or, you know, running out of the end zone to take a safety instead of losing the ball on the 1 yard line, whatever. But the point is, there are specific rules for doing those things, and you are penalized for those things. There is nothing in the rules of football that says if you commit pass interference, you're ejected. There's nothing in the rules of football that says if you run out of the end zone, you're ejected. There's nothing in the rules of basketball that says if you commit an intentional foul, you're ejected, unless it's seen with intent to injure, in which case you can be ejected. But it's very specific in the rules of golf that if you cheat, you are supposed to be disqualified.
John, earlier we had a chance to talk to Bruce Arena, who coached the team, obviously, to the loss that prevented the States from being part of the World Cup that's going on now in Russia. We've both read sections of his book, What's Wrong with U.S. Soccer, A Coach's Blunt Take on the State of American Soccer After a Lifetime on the Touchline. I want to ask you about it from a author perspective, from a book business perspective. He's kind of the newsmaker in why they're not there, or a big role in why they're not there, now profiting on a book about what he would do or his suggestions for the league. I asked him about it. He said, hey, I didn't surrender my right to an opinion on it.
Right.
I'm just wondering if you think it, if you find it shrewd, or if you have any debate with it, if you're curious about what he has to say or not.
Well, I mean, Bruce is right. He's got an absolute right to write a book, whether the U.S. wins the World Cup or doesn't make it to the World Cup. He's going to sell a lot more copies if the U.S. wins the World Cup than by not getting to the World Cup at all. I mean, that's just a basic business thing. People want to hear about winners. You know, I remember Davis Love saying to me after the U.S. won Ryder Cup, well, we gave you a happy ending for American readers anyway. So I don't have any quarrel with Bruce having the right to write any book that he so desires. And if a publisher wants to publish it, then go right ahead. I'm not sure there are that many people who are going to want to hear what Bruce has to say or read what Bruce has to say. Soccer is a niche sport, as you know, Paul, because you're a big fan of it. And I would think that the readership would be somewhat limited. I'll give you an example from one of my books. I wrote a book 11 years ago on Tom Glavine and Mike Messina. And Tom Glavine's season with the Mets ended that year with the pennant at stake, Glavine pitching last day of the season. He goes a third of an inning and gives up 7 runs. The Mets lose and don't make the playoffs. One of the people I sent the book early to was Gary Cohen, who's a longtime friend who's been the voice of the Mets for 30 years now. And Gary wrote me back a really nice note saying, hey, maybe it's because I know the subject, but I really like this book. I think it might be my favorite one of the book of your books. And I said, oh, great, Gary. I'm so glad you like it. You think I could get on for an inning at some point when the season starts to talk about the book? And he wrote me back and said, John, I love this book and I love you. There's not a Mets fan alive who ever wants to hear the name Tom Glavine again. And he was right. And I would think there are a lot of American soccer fans who aren't that eager to hear what Bruce has to say at this moment in time.
John Feinstein, we always enjoy what you have to say, John. Thank you for the time, and we'll do it again next week.
Look forward to it, guys. Thanks a lot. Take care.
See ya. John Feinstein has been our guest. He joins us each Monday here on the Midday 180.
We in America debate instant replay over and over in all of our sports. It is now part of soccer at the World Cup, and we get caught up in the same debate, the same language. Is it clear and obvious? And everybody's interpretations of that. We'll talk about that next.
I use Brentwood Hearing Center for my IFB, the hearing piece on the football sidelines on News Channel 5 on Friday Night Rivals. They are the hearing care provider in Middle Tennessee. Brentwood Hearing Center offers four doctors of audiology with more than 85 years of combined experience, led by Ann Bowling and Tanya Williams. Recent studies show that people wait sometimes as long as 7 years from when they first think they're having a hearing problem until they have their hearing checked. But there's no reason to hesitate. If you're like so many people, you've seen Brentwood Hearing Center right off of I-65, it's time to give them a call. Find out what sounds you've missed while you've been sitting around the family dinner table, sitting in that big meeting at the office, maybe on the golf course. Give them a call today at 615-377-0420. 377-0420. Brentwood Hearing Center, your sound solution for over 30 years. Their convenient location is right off of I-65 on Franklin Pike at the Brentwood Old Hickory exit. Pay them a visit at 5544 Franklin Pike, Suite 100, Brentwood Hearing Center. Sound solutions for better hearing. Schedule your appointment at 615-377-0420 or visit them online.